This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to Pressing Matters, the show that takes you behind the headlines to explore issues driving the press. I'm Diana Mustak, and my guest today is Adam Minter. He's a columnist on Bloomberg Opinion and the author of two books, the latest of which is called Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. It takes a deep dive into the world, or really the unseen trade of secondhand goods, and depicts the global nature of the industry. Adam, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your first book was called Junkyard Planet, Travels in the $1 billion Trash Trade. You've also spent two decades reporting on trash and recycling. How did you first become interested in this, and what made you build your career around such a niche topic?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a generational recycling family. My great-grandfather came to the United States in the early 20th century from Russia without any education, without any English language, without any skills. So he'd pick literally trash off the streets. And that rag picking grew into a small recycling business in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I grew up around that. And really grew to love it. But I wanted to be a writer. And so what do you do when you're starting out as a writer? You write about, you know, what you know. And I figured that I would, you know, start out just by writing about that for trade magazines and eventually transition into something else. But I didn't. It's just so interesting. And it's been growing in importance over the last 20 years. So I feel like I got lucky to be a part of this beat.
Right. And so let's take a look at your newest book, Secondhand. Could you tell us briefly what compelled you to write about it?
What compelled me to write about it was something that so many of us go through all around the world. My mother passed away, and she had a small apartment filled with things, her stuff. And it was up to my sister and I to figure out where to get rid of that stuff. And at the end of it, we were left with a few things, and we decided we'd drop them at a charity shop, a Goodwill in the United States, which is the largest chain of charity shops in the United States. And as we were dropping off her china, it occurred to me that I've been covering garbage and recycling my whole career, yet I didn't know what happened to that fine china after it went through the donation door. And so just at that moment, I said to myself, I think I should write a book about this. So initially, the book was just going to be about what happens when you give away your stuff. But it became about globalization, about what it is to be a consumer. It became a meditation on how much our stuff really does mean to us. Why do we hold on to it so tightly? And what does it take to let go of it?
I also wanted to spend some time helping our listeners visualize what it means for someone's beat to be trash and recycling.
Sure.
So tell me about your process researching for the book. How did you figure out where to start, because trash is literally everywhere.
Right.
No country is free of it. And so how did you, as a reporter, narrow in on the story?
So the easy part was this, is that I knew I wanted to report on Goodwill. So it's easy enough. You know, you just call up Goodwill. What I didn't expect was that they are a fairly closed organization. They don't welcome a lot of press scrutiny. But then from that point on, it's really just feeling things out. I wanted to spend time with the used clothing trade. I didn't know anything about the used clothing trade except for a business card I was given years ago. I called the guy up and he said, sure, I'd be happy to have you come to India. And then I thought, well, where does this stuff get sorted before it goes to India? And I just literally went online and started Googling. Many people told me, you should really go to Mississauga, Ontario. And I thought, why Mississauga, Ontario? I've never even heard of Mississauga, Ontario.
Right.
Turns out it's one of the great global hubs of recycling, of clothing. So I started literally just calling people. Then after months of calling and please let me come, finally somebody said, well, if you're here this 2-week period, I can take you around for a day. And that's how you do it.
We hear about this, and I think you allude to it in the book. The sale of secondhand goods is generally unseen.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really something that factors into the GDP of countries, really.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it comes down to how we view economic development around the world. You know, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, they aren't interested in funding secondhand businesses. They want businesses that create widgets that can be counted in an emerging market's GDP. And they can say, look, you know, the manufacturing is growing, the consumer class is growing. You know, that's how we measure economic growth. And so in that sense, there's just no interest for an emerging market country say in West Africa, where I spent a lot of time for this book, to report how many secondhand shops they have. The other side of it that's very difficult as well is that it can be, and often is, a gray market industry. So for example, I spent time looking at the flow of secondhand from the United States into Mexico, which is massive. Mm-hmm. It's a huge trade, but it's also 100% illegal because years ago, the Mexican government, at the behest of new goods manufacturers, said you can't import secondhand goods. And yet, so far as anybody knows, nobody's ever enforced it. So nobody's enforcing it. It's illegal. Right. So nobody's got an interest in declaring it. So that makes it all very gray.
Right. And it's hard to calculate.
There is nothing to calculate. I mean, I work for Bloomberg. I'm accustomed when I'm writing something, the first thing you do is you look up the data around it. But there are no numbers on how many, garage sales there are, how many flea markets there are. Nobody's recording that. It becomes a qualitative exercise.
And your book is really very colorful. It takes you kind of all over the world, from junkyard sales and Goodwills in the U.S. to even Amcor Mall in Petaling Jaya.
Right.
And, so many more in between. So what is the most interesting thing that you saw during your travels?
It was all interesting, but I spent time in Arizona just sitting at a door watching what comes through a Goodwill charity shop. And I spent hours watching that. I was astounded at the variety and the value and sometimes the lack of value of the stuff. It was just watching the tide come in, the tide come out. It was astounding to me. People would literally sort of dump whatever was in the junk drawer, including maybe 20-year-old Hershey's Kisses. I mean, at one point, being at a storage unit where there was 20-year-old cans of unopened Coca-Cola that somebody had been keeping. So it's just remarkable what gets kept and assumed that is going to be bought, sold, traded, wanted, loved.
Also, as I read your book, the one point I kept returning to over and over again was this idea that as societies become richer, they consume more and thus they discard more, right? Yeah. Could you elaborate on this?
Yeah. I mean, you're absolutely correct. The wealthier a country is, the more it throws away. And it's, you can literally plot it, the amount of garbage generated next to the GDP rising. So that creates some long-term challenges, if you want to think about how to manage this waste. You know, for years, the United States, Europe, Australia, Japan were wealthier. And so they always had markets available to them to export their secondhand stuff. That is still the case. But if you talk to anybody in the trade, they will say it's becoming less the case because the rest of the world is becoming wealthier. China used to be an importer of secondhand clothes. Now it's an exporter. So yeah, that is threatened long term.
Yeah. And clothes is a very good example where it's something that's gotten a lot cheaper. Right? And affordability for consumers is usually taken to be a good thing. And you say so yourself in the book, things becoming cheaper is often a blessing, but not always. Mm-hmm. But what do we do? I mean, if this is part of the problem of growing heaps of trash, we can't expect countries to become less rich or things like clothes to become more expensive. So how do we square that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any simple solution. You know, everybody says, well, what's the law we can write? And I don't think you can write a law that says you are mandated to buy more expensive stuff. You know, I have an inkling, and I talk about this in the book. I think as people realize that some of these low-cost garments, if we're just talking about textiles, you know, may only last 3, 4, 5 washes, and that good quality imported secondhand garment may last longer. We'll see some shifts, and probably more importantly, I think we'll see consumers start to demand better quality stuff. But again, right now, you know, the consumption, at least in emerging markets, is moving in the direction of cheaper and cheaper.
Right. Now, after the break, we'll dive into the culture of secondhand buying as well as environmental policies in Malaysia. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Thanks for staying tuned to The Morning Run. This is Pressing Matters, the show that takes you behind the headlines. I'm Diana Mustak, and my guest today is Adam Minter, columnist on Bloomberg Opinion and the author of Secondhand, Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. Now, zooming into Malaysia a little bit more, is there a culture of secondhand buying here?
Oh, yeah. I mean, secondhand markets in Malaysia are thriving, and they have for years. One thing that people don't realize, and I didn't realize, is that Port Klang is a hub for the global secondhand trade, especially in apparel and textiles. And there are large warehouses down there where clothing in particular is sorted. It's imported from around the world, sorted and re-exported all over South Asia, some of it to Africa. Africa, and it's been a major hub for years and years. So it's a very big business here in that sense, but also on a retail level. I mean, I live very close to the Amcourt Mall and the flea market, which I frequent pretty much every weekend. And, you know, if you spend time talking to the folks who buy and sell things at the flea market, you know that they have very extensive businesses. It's oftentimes not just a weekend businesses. They'll have shops, you know, in Old Town PJ, for example, filled with furniture, and they have very loyal customers. So yes, it's huge here. It's not as big as it used to be because Malaysia becomes more and more affluent, but there is still strong demand.
So as Malaysia becomes more affluent, do you see secondhand buying growing or decreasing? I mean, because with things like Craigslist and eBay, I mean, in Malaysia, people are also selling things on Facebook or Carousel. There are more avenues, but mm-hmm. Do you think there's more potential?
I do. And it's going to be interesting to see how things evolve. One outlet that I talk about extensively in the book is a place I'm sure many of your listeners know called Jalan Jalan Japan, which is owned by a company in Japan by the name of Book Off, which is Japan's second largest secondhand goods company, which is really saying something because secondhand is huge in Japan. And what they do is they re-export the stuff that they can't sell in Japan because they collect so much from Japanese people. And I believe there's now 3 Jalan Jalan Japan stores in the Kuala Lumpur area. The management of Jalan Jalan Japan told me they see enough market demand here for 10 such stores.
And that's saying a lot because these stores are huge.
They are huge. I mean, they are as big as, you know, some department stores you'll find attached to malls. But what I found really interesting is they said, you know, we have thought about, and, you know, they didn't say that we have plans, but we've thought about, you know, once we reach 10, we think we might be able to start buying things from Malaysians and not just importing from Japan, but, you know, reselling used stuff from Malaysians. And that's, I think that's possible. We already know Malaysians will sell stuff on Carousel. You know, it's a very, very, very small percentage. But as consumer classes grow and they generate more stuff and Malaysians know used stuff is worth money, I think you will see that grow.
So I'm curious, out of everything that ends up in secondhand stores, do most of them get bought?
Well, if we just talk about developed countries first, you know, on average, about 1/3 of the stuff that ends up on the retail shelves of a charity shop, a thrift store in developed countries sells. The other 2/3 ends up going somewhere else. So that could mean another charity shop, mm-hmm. But only about 10 to 12% of that stuff sells. And then the rest of it ends up being re-exported to other markets. Just talking about developed countries now, some of it, like with the apparel that can't sell, a very large percentage, nobody could ever give me a good number, ends up being turned into rags. And there's a huge rag-making industry here in Malaysia too, believe it or not. Stuffing for cushions in your sofa, for example. But inevitably, everything dies, and sooner or later, it's going to end up in a landfill. No product lasts forever. If you're in a place like Malaysia, at Jalan Jalan Japan, they are actually able to move, you know, the vast majority of the stuff they put out.
How much of the things that get dropped off even make it to the shelf in the first place?
You know, that's a really interesting question, and it all comes down to the thrift store. I thought what was really interesting is when I talked to thrift stores around the world, they think as hard as a traditional retail outlet about where they put their stores because they want to get donations and they want to sell. For example, Goodwill will put stores in very wealthy neighborhoods if they can get the neighborhoods to agree in the United States. Why? Not because there's huge buying there, but because the donations are excellent, because rich people throw away more stuff. So it all depends upon where you're located.
Do some of the stuff that doesn't get sold in Goodwills in the U.S. end up in those bundle stores in Malaysia?
Oh, sure. And it's really hard to trace, you know, how things go. It wouldn't be Goodwill saying, okay, we have a bunch of stuff in the back, let's send it to Malaysia. What they will end up doing is selling it to what's called a grader. And this is a company that will buy from thrift stores all over their region, and they will do thousands of pounds, sometimes hundreds of tons of sorting per day. And they know the various markets where this stuff will go. They may say, okay, there's a strong demand right now in Kenya for bed sheets used in hospitals. It's not just clothing. And they know where the markets are, and they're the ones in contact with the buyers in these various markets. And there's huge buyers who will call in Malaysia who will contact somebody in Mississauga, Ontario, and say, you know, I need a load of clothes. And if you can throw in more baby clothes with it, you know, great, we'll take it. So it's a very complicated global trade, but that stuff does come here.
Yeah, and I think that's a very important point that you've just touched on. It's extensively global. And while we're on Malaysia, we also have to talk about plastic.
Yeah.
While the Pakatan Harapan government was still in government, there are many reports from local and international media referring to Malaysia as a target of illegal waste trafficking. Mm. Could you paint a picture of the situation? How big of a problem is this really?
Well, just in terms of data, you know, this past year, 2019, Canada imported 2.5 times more waste plastics from the United States than Malaysia did. Why would Canada import garbage from the United States? Well, they wouldn't. What they want is raw materials. And waste plastics can be used in any number of ways. They can be remanufactured into new products. They can be turned into fuel. Now, it is the case that the amount of waste plastics, recyclable plastics and otherwise, that Malaysia imports has been growing over the last 2 years. And that's for two reasons. One, China closed most of its market. China still imports waste plastics from around the world, but not nearly as much as it used to. And so the Chinese recyclers needed somewhere to go, somewhere that they have relationships where they could bring this stuff in. And so they relocated many of them into Southeast Asia, not just Malaysia, but Malaysia was a prime place to be. And then we know there's been a lot of relocation of Chinese manufacturing. And those manufacturers in China had grown up over the last 25, 30 years using recycled materials from developed countries. And so naturally, they wanted to continue importing the same stuff they did in years past. Now, just to be clear, that isn't to say that all of these are above board recyclers and manufacturers, and some of the things they've imported, including their practices, are not something that you would want to import into Malaysia. But there is a market here, and this idea that this stuff has been dumped is a little bit of a misnomer. It's been paid for and imported.
Is there a distinction to be made between, you know, legal and illegally imported plastic?
It's a
The former minister, Yeo Byin, has made a big deal out of this, and I guess the impression is that they're sending back the plastic that has been brought in illegally. Mm-hmm. Is that your impression, or you know, what's the distinction to be made here?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, up until the last couple of years, Malaysia really did not have any regulations related to this. They didn't really go about distinguishing what was a waste plastic and what wasn't, what they could import. And so this trade, you know, thrived. And there was, you know, I first reported on Malaysian plastics, I believe in 2010, even before I had moved to Malaysia. And, you know, there were lots of people importing, including from Singapore. Nobody really interfered with it. It contributed to manufacturing. It contributed to job growth. And so nobody thought about it. But when China closed its doors to much of the plastics, people started looking at what is coming in with this huge surge. And folks who are not familiar with what waste plastics looks like, if you open up a shipping container and you look at it, you say, that's garbage. But if you're a waste plastics recycler, you say, wait a second, that's my product. I use that, you know, to make this or that. And it gets to a really interesting point, because I think we do allow, especially in emerging markets, wealthy countries to tell us what is or is not recyclable. What is the definition of waste? Or we use it ourselves. And so we got into this problem of nobody knew what the definition of waste was. In the end, over the last 18 months, I believe it's about 3,800 tons of waste plastics were re-exported from Malaysia as illegal shipments, that it couldn't be recycled, to places including the United States, but also Cambodia. Got shipments sent back, China, and that should really raise eyebrows, because why would Cambodia dump waste on, you know, Malaysia? 3,800 tons, that sounds like a lot. Unless you start looking at the figures, that's less than 10% of the total waste that Malaysia generates in a day. That's not to say it's okay, but it does put it in perspective. There is absolutely grounds for Malaysia to create better regulations around these waste plastics and define what it does and does not want coming in. You certainly do not want, you know, plastics coming in that have been tainted with medical waste, plastics tainted with food waste, you know. But I think you also want to develop these regulations in collaboration with industry here, manufacturers here. Malaysia has a, you know, a 40-year plastics recycling industry that has depended upon importing waste plastics from other countries, especially Japan, you know. Talk to them, figure out what they need, what they actually use to manufacture, and also make sure that they are doing it in a safe way. Be very clear about whether Malaysia wants to use waste plastics as fuel. And the other thing that Malaysia needs to think about, and it's not just Malaysia, but think about what are the alternatives. If you are not using waste plastics, what are you manufacturing your plastics from? You know, this is not just about plastic. It's about what raw materials we want to use. Is it worse for the environment to go dig another oil well somewhere? Or is it worse for the environment to import waste plastics and use them?
And we also have to talk a little bit about plastic pollution. WWF report said that we per capita consume about 16.8 kilograms of plastic, and some but not all of that winds up in the ocean. What do you make of Malaysia's efforts to curb plastic consumption and pollution?
I think it's very nascent, to be polite about it. And it's not something that I think it has focused on too much, but that's not unusual. I mean, Malaysia is, you know, is still an emerging market country, and waste management is usually not the highest priority. It's something that comes along later as you become wealthier. Again, I'm not excusing anything, but that's just where it is. And, you know, if you give governments priorities, you know, waste management isn't usually at the top of the list, but it's getting there because Malaysia is becoming wealthier. And as people become wealthier, you start to see the demand. This really encouraging, I think, exciting development of civil society, environmental organizations here. I'm a big believer in not banning, because I don't think bans work, especially in emerging market countries where somebody with, you know, with a garage somewhere can start a small plastic bag factory. I think the better option is actually to tax consumers of these things. And that's been shown to work and get people to consume less. Ultimately, it means that Malaysia is going to have to start investing in modern waste management. You know, I've seen varying figures, but only about 15% of Malaysia's waste, garbage, is actually managed to sort of a global standard. And that means it's time for Malaysia to start investing in better incinerators and better landfills, and that will make a difference.
All right. That was Adam Minter, author of Secondhand Travels in the New Global Garage Sale. You've been listening to Pressing Matters. I'm Diana Mostak, signing off for The Morning Run on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.